good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the Kelty Mental Health Resource Center's Pinwheel Education Series on Binge Eating Disorder. The Pinwheel Education Series is a monthly forum that brings together experts and persons with lived experience to talk about mental health and mental wellness. Everything related to the Pinwheel series, including a recording of today's session, can be found at www.keltymentalhealth.ca/pinwheel. And now, for those of you that are joining us for the first time, the Kelty Mental Health Resource Center is a provincial mental health and substance use information and resource center serving BC children, youth, and families. We also offer peer support to families and youth, as well as to people of all ages struggling with eating disorders. You can visit our website for more information, resources, and for our contact information. So I think we're just going to jump right in and get started. Our first speaker is here at the table with us. So Dr. Barbara Beach received her PhD in clinical psychology from Simon Fraser University in 1993. She has been studying and practicing in the areas of eating disorders for over 25 years. And in addition to private practice as a registered psychologist in Vancouver, she works in the provincial specialized eating disorder program for children and adolescents at BC Children's Hospital. So welcome, Dr. Beach.
Thank you. Thanks for the pleasure of being able to share some information about this. I have information and books. We're going to talk about what binge eating disorder actually is. And it's been recognized as a variant of an eating disorder since the 70s. But it's only had an official separate diagnosis since 2013, so that's just 2 years ago. And that's with the introduction of DSM-5. And this is the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. And this is now, binge eating is now a disorder. So I'm going to talk about the disorder versus the behavior. Episodes of binge eating behavior are required, of course, to get a diagnosis of binge eating disorder. So, but the behavior itself is not that uncommon. But sometimes people just need a little bit of a, like you have a sense of, oh, I know what, when I'm going to have a binge, you know what that people mean when they say that. But when we're talking about diagnosis, it's specified as eating much more than most people would in a short, like 2 hours or less period of time, in similar circumstances, which is important. So if this isn't a holiday meal, we'd all have a, really enjoy all the food at holiday or after Halloween. It's pretty usual for kids to eat a lot of candy on Halloween or at a pizza party. This is, in the same circumstances, you eat much more than most people would in that discrete period of time. The other thing that characterizes a binge is a sense of lack of control over eating. So I can't stop once I've started, or I can't control what or how much I'm eating, so what foods or how much. And that sense of lack of control is what makes it a binge and not just enjoying a large dinner. So to get the diagnosis, with DSM-5, they have a criteria of frequency of binging, according to that, once a week for 3 months. This is actually a lower criteria. The previous version was twice a week for 6 months. So that means it's a bit easier to get the diagnosis. And also three or more of the following. So eating faster than normal, eating until uncomfortably full, eating large amounts of food when not feeling hungry, eating alone because of feeling embarrassed, feeling disgusted with oneself, depressed or guilty afterwards. So from that, you can see there's a fair bit of distress and discomfort that goes with the behavior. And that adds to the diagnosis. It's also important in order to get the diagnosis of binge eating disorder is that the binge episodes are upsetting. They're distressing. And the other thing that is in the diagnostic criteria is that there's no compensatory behaviors. And that's what is common in bulimia nervosa is behaviors such as vomiting or, doing things in order to get rid of the food once it's eaten, exercising strenuously. So those are not necessary. So when you think about that diagnosis and you think about eating disorders, something to me really stands out is that there's one criteria that's essential to most eating disorders that is not present. And that is over-concern about shape and weight, thinking that weight and shape is really important. And that's not necessary to get a diagnosis of binge eating disorder. So that means that a variety of people can get this diagnosis, because of the behavior and the associated distress. And if over-concern about shape and weight is also something that is present for somebody, it gives a sign that that's harder for people to, it intensifies their upset feelings, and the distress is greater and the behavior is more upsetting. It's more difficult to change. Prognosis is a little bit more tricky. Treatment needs to address over-concern about shape and weight. So it's not essential that it's there, but it is a really common feature, and it's one that's concerning. When people give talks, they usually talk about treatment at the very end, and then they give it like 2 minutes because they've run out of time. So I'm trying to be really careful that we talk about treatment right up front. So treatment, one of the nice things about, there's not that many nice things about having a disorder that's upsetting, but the good news is that binge eating disorder responds well to treatment, and rates of remission are quite positive. People get better. Evidence, I brought my journal, there's journals on eating disorders. They have lots of evidence about binge eating disorder. Not so much since it's a pretty new diagnosis, but the evidence supports psychotherapies that are specific to binge eating behaviors and the associated symptoms. People get better with psychotherapy. There's a limited amount of evidence that antidepressant medication helps, and that's the SSRIs, selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors. There's some evidence that that helps, but it helps mostly with the distress, and the distress reduced, then you don't feel like binging quite as much, so then the binging reduces. So it is limited evidence. It's not as good effect as psychotherapy. There are a few other drugs that have been tested out, but I wouldn't highly recommend you go seek them out because there's a lot of side effects that they've been taken off the market. But recently, in the last month, the FDA in the U.S. has just approved Vyvanse, which is an ADHD drug, for use in binge eating disorder. I'm not sure that that's a very large, thumbs up for Vyvanse. Because, if I wanted to make a drug and make a lot of money, I would say, let's see how many eating disorders I can get my medication rated for. So back to psychological treatment modalities, which I know a whole lot more about. So I'm going to talk about the way that treatment is delivered. Of course, everybody knows individual psychotherapy. Group therapy is actually a good modality for binge eating disorder for a few reasons I'll discuss in a second. Support groups, which are less targeted, just more chatting about it and helping each other. Binge eating disorder has had a lot of people coming up with self-help. There's books like Overcoming Binge Eating by Christopher Fairburn, which is a standard in this area. And there's online help. So talking about the way treatment is delivered gives a lot more options. The access to treatment is a little bit tricky. One of the things that's very common in binge eating disorder is people feel a great deal of shame and they hide the behavior. And so binges are usually secret. And with this level of shame, it can make it really difficult to seek out treatment. Just making the phone call can be hugely hard to do. Calling up the Kelty and asking for information can be really difficult to do. The other thing that makes it hard to access treatment is the diagnosis has been around for 2 years. Different community mental health centers in BC have yet to get around to coming up with a program for binge eating disorder because they've been busy with things that are already in the manual. So now that it's a separate diagnosis of its own, I'm hoping that there's going to be a whole lot more treatment available. Okay, other kinds of treatments. There are many philosophies that I can throw you a long list of letters of the different approaches that have got some support in for binge eating disorder. I'm going to go through this super fast because I'm going to talk more about the way to think about treatment. So there's cognitive behavior therapy, which is CBT. There's interpersonal psychotherapy, IPT. There's DBT, EFT, all sorts of T's. Sure, I've missed a few. What I think is a more useful way of thinking of these is when people talk about binge eating, they often talk about having triggers to binge eating, things that set them up for a binge. For instance, feeling shame, feeling distress or unhappiness or emotions like that. So when you're looking for targets for change, you can look at the triggers as one way to work on changing this whole program. And it gives you a variety of different things to approach as far as treatment goes, and gives you, like, it's kind of like pointing more lasers at the situation to help get a better response. So the first one, of course, is reducing shame. And luckily, as soon as you make a phone call to tell somebody, I think I'm having problems with binge eating, you forced yourself to rip off a little bit of the band-aid of shame. Increasing self-acceptance, loving oneself, you know, taking yourself to treatment and helping yourself feel better that way is right there. Just even thinking about treatment actually helps you feel better about yourself. And then competence. As you make some of these changes, you'll feel more competent, and that will also help undo this big cycle. Distress tolerance. So being able to just tolerate the stresses of daily life, that is a skill. And it increases hopefulness. I always like to think about things in the positive way rather than taking away all these negatives. Hopefulness, you know, as soon as you talk to, you know that there's some treatments out there, hopefulness increases, and hopefulness is a good feeling and builds up for the future. Noticing negative affect and being able to, or feelings, being able to identify them. Sometimes people don't even realize that they're stressed or upset or anything. Or these feelings, so just simply identifying and saying, oh, I'm feeling a feeling. I personally hate, like, I like to think of all feelings as very useful, necessary symptoms. I don't call red lights bad. They're useful. I need to know to stop. It keeps me safe. So I need to know if I'm stressed. I need to know if I'm sad. I need to know if I'm going to face a loss or if there's a threat there. So feelings are very useful, very positive, even though there are many feelings that are very uncomfortable. So angry, lonely, sore, bored, anxious, this is distress tolerance. Those are often triggers for the behavior of binge eating. And, you know, when you can start to look at, okay, here's a trigger, this is what I do next, and then I go to the fridge, and, you know, recognizing the patterns of behavior, finding alternate ways of coping, different patterns of behavior, or creating a new neural path. As you know, instead of going to the fridge, I'm going to go for a walk, or I'm going to call a friend, or, you know, I'm going to go journal in my, you know, coming up with some alternate ways of coping and putting those into practice, another target of change. Just simply remembering that you need to go and do something different helps. Another target for change is how you handle stressful situations. Since shame is such a big part of it, often when people are struggling with eating issues, they detach themselves from other people. And then social situations become much more anxious, and then you lose track of your social skills, because if you don't use it, you'll kind of lose it. So getting people back connected with other people, building up some social skills, some competence in interacting with other people. And of course, we all have difficult social situations in our lives, so just practicing some of those skills, which is one of the reasons why group treatments are often really helpful. Reduces shame, increases interpersonal competence, gives a sense of self-acceptance when everybody else in the room is appreciating them. That can be a really helpful thing. So coping skills and interpersonal skills. Other targets for change, people are triggers, and one trigger for binge eating is often just the presence of food. You know, if you know that there's a box of donuts in the or something like that, that is a trigger for a binge. And changing one's attitudes around food and dieting and shape and weight, these are another target for change. So a regular eating approach, so eating, we always say 6 times a day, 3 meals, 3 snacks, eating a variety of foods, seeing foods are not, just like red lights, they're not bad. Foods are all good. There's a place for every food, even candy, because it gives you quick energy. You need that, and there's certain times that's very, very appropriate. So kind of coming to think about foods as not good or bad, but just food, kind of helps, like, it's okay for you to have this, or it's okay for you to have that. So you can have it and really enjoy it and experience mindful eating instead of mindless eating and numbing eating, and not dieting. Accept food, accept yourself, and see that there are many other ways, many other valuable aspects of yourself in your life other than shape and weight. So looking at a values approach, what are the values that you have in your life that are important? Social relationships may be important, family, friends, work, and focusing more on those aspects of life. Kind of one of the things, it's kind of like an approach of, if you have your life divided into all the different things you do, and weight and shape have just taken a large portion of the things you value, rather than shrinking it down, in order to shrink it down, you enlarge all the other things you do. You focus on hobbies, you focus on relationships, you focus on, the getting in touch with nature, whatever is really important to you, spirituality, and that helps you, that naturally puts some pressure on the part of your self-worth that is tied up with weight and shape. It's often a very tricky thing to attach. There's also some really specific body shape and weight acceptance behaviors and, you know, things that you may target if that's a something specific to that particular person. Okay, well, I have other information that if it comes up in questions, I'll answer, but I think I'll turn the page over to Andrea.
Am I next?
No.
Okay.
No, sorry. Okay, Claire.
So Claire Winterton holds a master's degree in counseling psychology and has been with the South Vancouver Island Eating Disorders Program since 2002. Claire sees youth and young adults with eating disorders through this program. Trained in dialectical behavior therapy, she, in collaboration with colleagues on the South Island team, enjoys delivering the current DBT group programming for adult clients who struggle with binge eating disorder or bulimia. So welcome, Claire, and go ahead.
Okay. I'll just, I might have written in my bio by mistake, but we do see more than young adults. We see youth and young adults, and all the way through the age spectrum. So, so what I'm going to describe is the group programming that we've been delivering for a few years. Actually, we included people struggling with binge eating disorder in this group programming kind of before it became an official diagnosis. And so just to start out, we took a book, a manual, that offered a group program, or it could be delivered individually or a group program. It's called Dialectical Behavior Therapy for Binge Eating and Bulimia, and it's by Deborah Safer, Christy Telch, and Eunice Chen. And there's a foreword by Marsha Linehan, who is the psychologist who originated this type of therapy called dialectical behavior therapy. And just a brief mention in that Dr. Linehan originally designed dialectical behavior therapy to help people struggling with the diagnosis of borderline personality disorder, and who frequently were struggling with behaviors such as self-harm or frequent suicidal risk. And the therapy has been broadened to be used in all sorts of places, alcohol and drug problems, and also with eating disorders. So that's kind of the main basis. But we have tweaked what is in that book, and what we have is what ends up being, over the course of a year, a all told 28-week group, but it's split up into 3 8-week modules and 1 4-week module. So that's just kind of the structure, and again, it's open to adults, so anybody 19 and up who is struggling either with bulimia or with binge eating disorder. And So I'll speak a little bit. I don't thank you, Barbara, for your presentation. You said all sorts of things that I'll be able to just mention that the way this model addresses binge eating disorder. You already have mentioned it, so that's great. The model underlying how clients are supported to work in this group is an emotion-centered model. It sees, again, emotion as central to the process of what is driving the continued binge eating behavior. So the binge eating behavior is seen as a behavior that, and I think Barbara, you used the words coping mechanism, the binge eating behavior is seen as in a way a coping mechanism with an experience of when somebody is feeling overwhelmed by their experience of emotions and they have a sense of urgency that they want to stop that kind of rising emotion escalation that they're experiencing inside themselves. And they really, you know, we all need to regulate our emotions, that we all need to kind of be able to be with them and be socially and still have our emotions. And so binge eating becomes a way of coping with overwhelming emotions. Unfortunately, it doesn't give people then, it only lasts temporarily that it helps. And it also hurts people in the long run in that they have a sense of possibly of decreased self-esteem, an increased sense of not seeing themselves very positively, guilt, shame. And they also don't get to practice other types of skills, skills that might be we would consider kind of more adaptive to and that don't hurt them. Like, you know, one example of a skill we use in this group or we teach in this group is diaphragmatic or deep abdominal breathing, and things like some of the things Barbara mentioned too, just other types of skills, even interpersonal skills. And part of this model is that the idea is that people who are struggling with binge eating disorder, the kind of the underlying theory of it is that they have trouble regulating their emotions or the words. They have trouble understanding them, being able to put a name to them, and if they want to try to influence them, to change them somewhat. We can't stop emotions. Emotions just come and go kind of like waves on an ocean. And we learn through the course of our development to be with them and let them inform us. The idea is that people struggling with binge eating disorder haven't really, on some level, had a chance to learn how to do that. And the model is proposing that there's kind of also a biological sensitivity, a kind of temperamentally not oversensitive, but just a sensitive temperament, and perhaps the person has not had an environment growing up, and that's not necessarily saying within families, it could be experienced in many places, but just where their experience of themselves and their emotion has not been validated. And so over time, what it results in is as an inability and kind of deficits in those skills to be with emotion. So I went into a bit more detail about that because it really speaks to kind of why the rest of the group, why the group is set up as it is. So I'm just going to jump to the group structure. We have a 4-week group that we call Ready, Set, Go. And it's 4 weeks, and there's an orientation to the group and an orientation to the model and some the main tools that we use. And then there's also one session. It's a two-hour-a-week group. There's also one session on nutrition and things like metabolism and normal eating, just to make sure that everybody who's attending the group has at least had a chance to get that kind of information. Because DBT isn't necessarily the first line or first treatment of choice for somebody struggling with binge eating disorder, I think CBT kind of rates higher. I'm not sure where interpersonal therapy rates, but the suggestion in the manual that we used was that other modes of treatment should possibly be tried first, and I can speak to that a little bit later of why we've gone in this direction. So in the first four-week group, people learn, and Barbara has already again spoken to this, they learn about observing and describing their behaviors using a behavioral chain. She didn't quite use those words, but it's the idea of recognizing patterns. And so because the behavioral chain is something we do all throughout the 28 weeks, almost every week of the group, and people are to do those, they take an episode of binge eating disorder and they observe and describe, you know, what happened, when did it first, what was a prompting event or a trigger, what might have made them vulnerable that day to that particular prompting event having, you know, leading to the binge eating. And they look at the links between when the trigger happened and when the actual binge occurred. And then they also look at and observe and describe, and this is all in a non-judgmental way, about kind of what are the consequences, how do they feel afterwards, what benefit might they have got from that, what, again, speaking to the temporary relief or the temporary benefits they may have got from the behavior, and that it, relief is actually a common one, and we all need relief when we're feeling stressed out or when we're overwhelmed by our emotional experience. So We teach people how to use the chain. We teach them how to use a diary card where they keep kind of notes of what happens for them throughout the week, on things about what are their emotional experience like, what degree of intensity was an urge to binge, did they binge. They keep track of, you know, what things might I have done that I sort of thought, you know, didn't have anything to do with binging, but later, if I really truly thought about it, it was actually setting myself up for a binge. That could be, you know, driving home from work, stop and pick up, while I'm doing my shopping, I'll just pick up this couple bags of cookies, you know, I'll give one to my sister when I see her tomorrow. And on back in the mind might be something like, I think this might be making me vulnerable to binging, but it kind of just... keep it, you kind of, the person just does it anyway, and we call that apparently irrelevant behavior, and with increasing awareness it becomes relevant behavior. So those are the main tools, and then the modules are, again, a lot about what Barbara introduced. There's a full module on what we call emotion regulation, and I won't say too much more about that, it's just learning to how to be with emotions, how to identify them, how to make it more so that you'll experience more positive emotions and reduce the vulnerability to negative emotions. I don't like calling emotions positive or negative, but and then the other things are, I'm just checking my time. I'm thinking I'm going to be needing to finish soon. Can you tell me how, do I have any more minutes or is that...
Yeah, you're good.
I'm still good? Okay.
Yep.
That's the emotion regulation part. And then there's a full module, 8-week module on distress tolerance, as Barbara has mentioned. And then we do an 8-week module that we have kind of created almost using the manual, but also... on our own, added in a few bits, and that's, we call it living and eating mindfully, and we do a lot of mindful eating practice within the group, starting with a small bite of food and moving eventually by the end of the 8 week to a shared meal. And I have failed to mention that underlying in all of these skills is the practice of mindfulness. I think I did mention that the observing and describing and non-judgmental stance. Those are all parts of what we call mindfulness, and people may have heard mindfulness and before, and it's about kind of being in the moment in a non-judgmental way, simply noticing what is. Kind of that's a brief description of mindfulness, and all of that mindfulness underlays and overarches all of the skills that we do. And so those of it, we do try to pepper in some interpersonal, and if we did have more time and more resources, we would probably do a full 8 week interpersonal module, but that's not we're not able to do that. So we just kind of pepper that in throughout the weeks. And again, this just speaks again to some of what Barbara said, is that the group, we find people feel less alone. It substantially reduces their sense of shame. They come to know the behavior of binge eating as simply a behavior, that it's there for, it's developed, it's kind of an overlearned thing that's developed for a reason, and they get to know it, we're really clear right from the outset that there needs to be, and we can think of it as a process and a skill, a commitment to stopping binge eating as a way of coping with emotions. And that's a big part of the beginning of the group. It's just the really taking it seriously. This is not helping me in my life. It causes huge amounts of distress and isolation and things like that Barbara has talked about. So that commitment is a big part of it. Dialectical, I'll just briefly speak to the name of the therapy, is a dialect. A dialectic is like a polarity. It's got two ends to it. And one end, the idea with dialectical process is each end has a truth in it. And it's not about proving one wrong and one right. And the main dialectic that we work with is acceptance and change, is that people need to accept that they have this issue and that it's something real in their lives, and at the same time they're also accepting and knowing that they need to work on change. And that kind of underlies a process and the mindfulness underlies the idea that people get comfortable with being 100% committed to never binging again on a certain day, and then if it occurs, then they learn how to accept, okay, I've failed on my 100% goal I was holding, and then they really mindfully integrate what happened using the chain, and in that way they really learn about themselves and about changing their behavior. The group in general, it's hard to make behavior change, and the group in general is supportive to people in doing that. I think I'll stop there.
Thank you so much, Claire. Okay, so our final speaker is sitting right beside me. So Andrea is a forced youth in residence working out of the Kelty Center, and she has lived experience with anxiety. She has also had a decade-long struggle with her views on food and eating, and has worked past her challenges, which included binge eating disorder in her early teens and bulimia in her late teens. So welcome. Go ahead.
Thank you. So I just want to clarify for everyone that I was never diagnosed with binge eating disorder. When I was, in my early teens, that was not in the DSM, and I wasn't very open with it. But when, we look at the diagnostic information, I definitely did have that. And I just want to give everyone kind of a picture of where it started. And I definitely think it started when I was very young, because my home life was very chaotic, and it wasn't, chaotic in the sense that I didn't feel like my parents cared for me or something. They absolutely did, but we'd come to Canada as refugees, and when I was 3 years old, and my parents were busy learning English, working two jobs, and it felt like there was really nobody who was really focused on me. So I kind of took it upon myself to make sure not to do anything that, you know, make anything more difficult for anyone. And I was always very conscientious, and I was one of those overly sensitive children. And my parents loved that about me, but at the same time, it made me very prone to being, you know, oversensitive, to taking comments the wrong way, or, you know, if somebody kind of like gave me a look, I'd be like, oh my God, they hate me. And it just turned into a very black and white view of things, a black and white view of emotions for sure. You know, if I was feeling anxious, you know, that was bad and nobody could know about that, and I would just pretend to be happy because that was much easier for everyone else. And that kind of level of secrecy, I think it's quite common to see in most eating disorders. And it eventually turned into secrecy about eating. Because, you know, when I turned 13, I definitely was like, I developed early and I was totally embarrassed about it. And I obviously blamed food. And so food to me turned into this thing where it wasn't there to nourish me, and it wasn't there to, you know, give me the vitamins and minerals and nutrients I needed. It was this embarrassing thing that was like, I started to not be able to control myself around it. And my mom noticed that, and she was trying to help me in her own way. And I think on some level she made it worse, because, you know, she was asking me like, do you really need that second serving? And no, I didn't, but I wanted it. And so I just decided, you know, I'd keep it a secret. So I'd eat normally in front of my mom, and then, you know, at night when everyone was asleep, I would eat everything in the house. My mom was getting so confused. She was like, where is all our food going? And it wasn't like in the moment it did make me feel better, but it definitely wasn't, like, I wouldn't say it was enjoyable. The binges were like I have friends who are recovering from alcoholism, and they tell me, you know, when I drink, it's like a switch suddenly flips and I can't stop. And that's what it felt like with food for me. If I went past a certain point, I would just keep eating and eating and eating. There were times that, you know, I'd be crying and eating and I couldn't stop. And it's definitely not something you want to talk about as a teenager, because, you know, a lot of teenage girls, I think, are very focused on, you know, having the perfect physique and stuff. And you see it in magazines, and you see, you know, movie stars, and think to yourself, I don't measure up. And then beyond that, there's this embarrassing thing going on where I can't control myself. And it's like you hide pieces of yourself, and it makes it so difficult to love yourself, because you feel like nobody else does. Because you're like, oh, if they knew that, you know, I was anxious and I was, you know, binging behind closed doors, they wouldn't actually love me. So the secrecy and the shame, it's not just there when you're binging. It's there, like, all the time. And it wasn't until, you know, I developed bulimia that I started, you know, getting questions and people, like, wanting to help me. But it's sad, because I feel like a lot of people say, you know, like, why can't you just control yourself? Like, just stop eating. But I really think that when it becomes a coping tool that's that powerful, it goes beyond your control and it becomes an addiction. And it's been such a long road for me in terms of developing a healthy attitude towards food. I still, you know, like, you still see on the fronts of magazines, like, lose 5 pounds in 2 weeks with this diet, or, you know, like, eat this so that you can, you know, lose your tummy. And it's always tempting to pick it up and flip through it. And I've realized for me, I just can't do that. I can't look at diets. You know, I can't really read, like, fashion magazines like Cosmo and stuff like that. It just doesn't put me in a good place. And sometimes, you know, it is embarrassing that, you know, I have these things that I know are triggers and I have to avoid them. But at the same time, I've kind of gotten past that. And I know that it's just what I have to do for myself. And I know that I can't eat in front of the television, because then I'm not paying attention. And then, you know, I hit that point where the switch flicks and it becomes, you know, too much for me to handle, and I can't control myself, and I start eating. And I tend to, you know, have to plan my meals very carefully and plan out my portions carefully, because with, you know, the decade or so of abusing my stomach, I've really lost the ability to feel when I'm hungry and when I'm full. And I have a very hard time, like, when I feel full, for a lot of people, when they feel full, they're like, oh, okay, this is getting uncomfortable, I'll stop. But for me, when I feel full, it's almost a trigger, like, oh, like, I could do more. And my mom's told me, because I actually, like, did start talking to my mom about it, she said, you know, sometimes I wonder if it's because, you know, when you were a baby, we were living in a war zone, you weren't getting enough to eat, and I think you kind of really became over-focused on food. So it's hard to pinpoint where it started, and I feel like there's so many things that go into it, and I feel like really that's why treatment needs to be multifaceted. It needs to address, you know, what behavioral patterns are leading you to do this, and also, you know, what emotions are going on when you're doing this. What is it that you're feeling? And beyond that, I really think people need to be better educated on it. In my high school, like, there were so many insensitive comments. Obviously, like, you know, there was, like, they would say things, and I really, you know, for the first 2 years or so, you know, I hadn't really gained weight, but there was this one kid who would, like, call basically every girl fat, because if you want to hurt a girl, call her fat, like, that's it. So once he called me that, like, that was it, and I completely lost any sense of, you know, like, I'm a good student, you know, I'm a conscientious daughter, I'm a good person. All of that was gone. It was just like, I'm fat. And then that becomes the center of your whole life. But now I really, yeah, like, I really have to make a conscious effort to focus on other things in my life. And it's very easy for me to fall into traps. Like, if I start, you know, working out, I have to make sure that I don't go and start overdoing it, because I have done that before. And if I start eating, I have to make sure I don't overdo it. And it's, like, sometimes it's exhausting, but it's definitely worth it. I feel much better now. And you have to take the time to really figure out what you need.
And that's it. Thank you. Thank you so much. So now we have lots of time for questions. So I'm just going to take the phone back off mute.
Conference is no longer in lecture mode.
And I'm going to open it up for questions for our speakers. I'm going to start with the folks on telehealth. If you have a question, you can just unmute yourself and go ahead and ask if anybody has any questions.
I have a question. Is there any online access to the DBT group?
This is Claire. I wish that was possible. No. It's for clients who, we don't have that technology.
I think it's an excellent idea. And I know that, I haven't actually gone and looked, and maybe Amy or somebody from Kelty has more, but there are different kinds of online resources, but I haven't done a personal search to find out how you would access those.
And I just wanted to ask, with regard to ordering that workbook that you mentioned, how would it be ordered?
I was so excited actually by your question. I'm like, God, wouldn't that be great? And then I was like, oh gosh, no. It wasn't a workbook I mentioned. It was it's actually a manual for people delivering the treatment approach. But I have here in front of me, I don't think there is a particular dialectical behavior therapy workbook for binge eating disorder yet. I bet something will come out fairly soon. There's one that we just recently got. It's called the Dialectical Behavior Therapy Skills Workbook for Bulimia. And so it would be using that same approach, but for bulimia. I haven't myself had a chance to look really thoroughly at this yet, but it might be somewhat helpful. There's another one, similar title. It's called the Dialectical Behavior Therapy Skills Workbook. Practical DBT Exercises for Learning Mindfulness, Interpersonal Effectiveness, Emotion Regulation, and Distress Tolerance. And the author of the The latter one is Matthew McKay and Jeffrey Wood and Jeffrey Brantley. But that doesn't discuss issues around food or body image specifically, but we pull in things from that workbook into the group. The one I forgot to mention, the author of the first one, that it's Ellen Ass. No, it's a very long name. Astrachan Fletcher. Astrachan-Fletcher. Fletcher.
So, this is Barbara here. I've actually looked at that book that Claire mentioned, the DBT book for bulimia, and I got it through like Amazon or Indigo. If you're in Vancouver, you could go to Odin Books on Broadway. If you're looking for a special deliverer, there's Gurze, G-U-R-Z-E, which is from the States. But the cheapest deal is definitely Amazon or Indigo. If you just look there are quite a variety of different workbooks that are around binge eating or bulimia, which includes a component of binge eating.
Thank you.
Okay, other questions from the phone?
Yes, I do have one question. My name is Christina, and I have a question around, is anybody gathering the stats or the numbers on the number of people that are coming forward for binge eating disorder treatment so that we can sort of illustrate in British Columbia the financial need to treat clients and make it more open for service availability?
That's a really good question. I'm not sure. Is anybody at the Kilty keeping track?
We do have to log calls, and I think a lot of the time we do get calls for binge eating disorder, people have like a really hard time getting help. So I think like we could have access to our logging, but other than that.
And from a general perspective, the prevalence is about 2 or 3% of the population, more women than men, but not by only by a factor of 2, not like 10 for bulimia nervosa, which is 10 women for every man. As people are realizing it is now not just a variant of another eating disorder, it's a legitimate eating disorder of itself, I think it's really a good idea for people to be lobbying the community mental health centers and other resources for treatment to be providing treatments.
Claire, do you folks kind of track?
They give treatment.
Yeah. No, we don't track. It seems to vary within our group. Sometimes we have more people struggling with binge eating disorder in the group versus bulimia, and sometimes it's more people with bulimia versus binge eating disorder.
Right.
There are always some people with binge eating disorder in our group.
Yeah, it's a great suggestion that we should put out to the Provincial Eating Disorders Network to keep some information of the demand for services. And one of the other things is that if we create services for binge eating disorders, they will come, and then we'll have more demand.
Okay, how about questions from the room? Do we have questions here? Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, first of all, I'm quite interested in the neurotransmitters because more and more things are coming up saying that if you recreate new pathways in the brain, it helps. Mm-hmm. How much research is being done on that, number one?
There is a whole area of research that's happening now. A couple of years ago, discussion, and because it's been a new, both the brain research ability to be doing great research that way, and also the binge eating disorder, there's only the beginnings of research on the neurotransmitters and the brain pathways, and you know, targeting things like dopamines and serotonin, of course, but that's coming out. This was like, oh, future direction, yes. Let's have more research in brain pathways and neurotransmitters. So it's coming.
Okay. Second question.
And from the DBT perspective, mindfulness, there's a lot of research out there about mindfulness creating new pathways in the brain. So practice of mindfulness, and so not specific neurotransmitters or pathways there, but
second
I guess in general, it's being seen that the brain is plastic through the lifetime.
Yeah, I decided that.
Not as easily, but.
Second question, has anybody looked at whether women and periods, whether that has any effect on any of this? Just questions.
Periods?
Yeah, having a period, whether it does.
Yeah, that is an element of these things. Well, it's just that you can't really change a period, so it's a target for treatment.
No, but I'm
so
sort of thinking whether it's
hormonal,
you know, it's related to the hormonal
thing. And I think you probably could take a little, you know, quick poll here and say how many people notice a variation in your...
Yeah, probably most women.
Yeah.
And the next question is, have you ever noticed a relationship between people who either drug or abuse alcohol in terms of this?
Yeah, there's a high level of comorbidity with depression, with alcohol abuse, and other substance abuse, partly because of the mechanism of, having... the things we talked about, so they're often comorbid. They go along with it, and you can get both diagnoses at the same time.
Now, in a lot of the things that I do with some of the adolescents about stress reduction and breathing, sounds like it fits in with this.
Absolutely.
Okay. Thank you.
I was just going to make a point. You mentioned addiction and talked about the word addiction, and I do want to make the point of, there is also a whole area of, Overeaters Anonymous and using an AA model with binge eating disorder, which I didn't talk about. And one of the things, it fits with people's experience, but one of the things that's really different is that you never have to have a drink again of alcohol, but you have to have food 6 times a day. And we live in grocery stores and just driving down the street, so you can't avoid it. You need to have a different management strategy and recognize, Andrea accomplished with turning things around involved her recognizing both the addictive quality and also to the fact that this is something you need to manage, not something you can just avoid, which is different from I'm never going to touch a drop of alcohol or crack again.
Okay. Other questions from the room?
Just one. There was a mention of the treatment being for 19 and over. Is there any treatments locally that would be for under 19? And how accessible is that?
As far as I know, with the community mental health centers, they probably ought to be including binge eating disorder in their treatments, and certainly at Children's, because we're dealing with the most serious. We don't offer anything specifically here. Mm-hmm. So the community mental health centers that are child and youth mental health would be the place to look for. And of course, if you look private practice, you find somebody who works with adolescents.
But and we do offer treatment for youth with binge eating disorder. We just don't have a group treatment program for youth in Victoria for binge eating disorder, but they do get service individually.
Yeah, one of the things is that with binge eating disorder, because of the secrecy and shame, it often takes many, many years before somebody will seek treatment. And so they've gone through their teen years and gotten into their 20s and 30s, sometimes 40s, 50s, before they've sought treatment. So if we're looking for the number of people that come forth seeking treatment, the average age is in the 20s, 30s, 40s of who's seeking treatment. And so you don't get that large group of teenagers seeking treatment just for, they're younger, they're...
Indispensable.
They're invulnerable, that sort of thing. And also, too, if you look in the media, there's a lot of normalization of binge eating behavior. Mm-hmm. It's like, oh, he broke up with me, I'm getting the Häagen-Dazs. Mm-hmm. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, it's just where I work, we're in the addiction, so often they'll be using to lose the weight or cope with the feelings, and when they come in and they're detoxing, then that's when the increase of the eating comes in, and some of them are aware of it, but at the same time it's connecting them to those services and making sure that it's close within where they normally reside.
Yeah, that is the challenge, and that's where having concurrent services or people who are aware of, oh, this would actually make it worse, is that's the first step. That's sometimes all that really is needed at times, is recognition of, yeah, that's a behavior just like the rest of the stuff. So it kind of fits under your umbrella. Sorry.
No.
A little bit. Here you go.
Other questions in the room?
I had one question to Claire. Claire, you mentioned earlier that something about maybe DBT not being the first line of treatment, and that you might have something to say about that still. I don't know if we actually went through that.
Oh, yeah. No, it's a brief comment in that I mean, to out myself, I'm not the best person to quote research statistics, so being more just a clinician. but my understanding, and maybe Barbara can speak to this, is that CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy, might be what research says is the first thing, kind of the best practice treatment for clinicians to try first with somebody with binge eating disorder.
The reason I didn't kind of go too much into do CBT first, which is, you know, focusing on the same variety of symptoms that we've talked about, you know, eating issues, behavior issues, emotional issues, thoughts and feelings, is because a lot of the treatments like DBT are addressing all of those things. And, you know, you have a period of time where you're talking about nutrition and attitudes around food and weight and shape and thoughts. But the research with cognitive behavior therapy, since it's been around longer, it's been around since the 80s, 70s, there's more research supporting that as an effective mechanism. And there's more manualized treatment for that. So that's part of the reason why it's usually thought of as kind of the first level treatment, and it has been shown to be quite effective.
Yes, and we've chosen to go the DBT route because we're a community program and we are seeing people with kind of comorbid problems as well, like alcohol and drug as well, or self-harming behaviors. And although we have some criteria around what we, you know, whether people, we can have them in groups at certain times, we find our groups can help people address those issues to some degree as well.
And it's broader, it's kind of broader than cognitive behavior therapy.
Yeah.
Well, I just looking at the clock, I realized that it's 1 o'clock. That went by so quickly. So thank you to all of our speakers. If you are in the room or on the line and you had additional questions for our speakers, you can just email me or email KeltyCenter@bcmhs.bc.ca. So thanks again to our speakers and everyone that's here, and have a great week.